like when you landed? I mean, just maybe if you can remember what the scene was like at the airport. Was there a greeting committee? The limos?
Okay. Remember, this was 1967.
Yeah.
And in this country in 1967, as African Americans, we were still living in, if for want of a better way to put it, in the belly of the bowels of racism. And, you know, still at that point in time, it was colored only, and separate seating areas, separate restrooms, separate water fountains, et cetera. And when we got off that plane in the UK, and I'm sure you remember this, Carla, I mean, it was like we could not believe, and let me just say it bluntly and frankly, here are all of these white people out here welcoming us to London, England, when here in America we were facing on a daily basis white people that were looking at us as though we were less than human and treating us in that same manner. That blew our minds as African Americans. And of course, I can imagine just hearing comments in the past from Wayne Jackson, Steve Cropper, and Duck Dunn, with the white guys that were with us, it made them feel good because they weren't getting some of the criticisms that they were experiencing back in this country in the communities where they lived. That was one thing. The other thing, and very important to us, but one thing that stayed with me as we toured across the continent, I could not understand for the life of me, given our experiences here in America at white radio stations, even at some black radio stations, and with music appreciators, while we were being treated, meaning us at Stax in particular, because we had that authentic, if you will, music that came from our culture, and it was authentic. We didn't try to dress it up. It was what that person, that artist, how that person was gifted, and we tried to capture that gift. And we were viewed through the eyes of racism here. So as we traveled across the continent of Europe with all white audiences, packed venues, and all of these white young people, older people, male, female, just excited about our music and not speaking the language. I remember particularly in Paris, France, where they're not speaking the language, and it was very obvious, but they could sing and speak every lyric in the songs that were being performed. And I couldn't understand it, what it was. And I finally grew, just being diplomatic in my question from time to time, to appreciate that as we went throughout Europe, the people in Europe viewed us as African Americans in the true sense of the word, and they were appreciating our music as an art form that came from the African American culture. So they didn't view it through eyes of racism. They saw it as an art form coming from our culture here in America. And we had never been even given the idea, generally speaking, that we even had a culture, to even talk about a culture. But when I realized that, it gave me, it broadened, and all of us in different ways, our perspective on what we were doing and made us even prouder of what we were about. But that was a great awakening and eye-opening for me.
Very good. Can you hear everybody? I want to get two responses from the people in the room. First, I'm going to ask Carla to elaborate on what you said about landing in 1967.
Oh.
And then I want to ask the students about, and you can think about this also while maybe Carla's answering, about representing the United States the way it is right now in 2017.
Well, actually, I'm sure it couldn't be. I'm sure it's overwhelming to them first. Because as one of the young men said, they realize that this academy is built on a legacy. And this is what one of the young men said. It was very bad. I will take with me when I leave here, because And that legacy that they have, that we have been the foundation of, and that they're continually building and building and building, their response can't be anything but the same as, or even greater, because it's coming from youth. We started as young people. But like I was saying, we didn't even understand, like, all this cultural stuff. We just knew it felt good, and we could sing, we could play, we could dance, whatever we could do, and we brought it here. But they're building on what we did. And they're still going further, going different places. They're seeing more from different cultures' acceptance of us. For me, being an artist, maybe more so, it was just overwhelming because my major was literature, and Renaissance literature. So I'm being in Europe, I'm being in London, and seeing Duck and all. Duck was one of the prime reasons I talked about this earlier, how Duck got down on the ground and said, "Whoa, this is just like the history books." And it was me, we're right at the airport. So I'm like saying, "Oh, Lord." And everybody's walking away from him like, "Who is that guy? I don't know him." But it was overwhelming, not just to us as African Americans, but as he was saying, it was overwhelming as well to Steve and Doug.
Okay, now the same questions for all four students here and your trip to Australia, Amber, representing the United States today. I mean, Chris, I'm going to kind of follow on what you said about D.C. I mean, the feeling you, I mean, that was just so great what you said about performing in D.C. That was real powerful stuff. But, I mean, what do you anticipate the reaction will be as America, Black Americans today?
Well, based on what I've heard, I expect, you know, a lot more hype than, you know, what we receive here in America. But representing the United States over there, I kind of want to change the stereotype that is put on Black teenagers. Because, you know, most of the time when people see Black teenagers, they think, oh, he's about to do something violent or something like that. So being able to go to Europe, you know, sending a positive message, I kind of want to shift that stereotype to show that, you know, not all young Black teenagers are what you think they are, because I'm the total opposite, you know. I don't really fight people. I don't like that. And I'm grateful that I can go over there and attempt to change the stereotype. I can't say I'm going to do it, but I can attempt. You know, I can always attempt to change it, that, you know, to show that not all Black teenagers are what you think they are.
I think,
Amber?
Yep. Yes. When you travel to Europe, like when we were in Australia, I think there are two things that are on the agenda as a young African-American performer. Like Chris just said, you know, you have kind of, I won't say the responsibility, but the task of, you know, demolishing those stereotypes, because people all over the world watch TV, reality TV, and it's not always the greatest picture or the most accurate picture of who African-Americans are. So, you know, you have the task of going over there and really just, you know, exposing the world to true Black excellence and excellence, period. And then you also have the task of upholding the legacy, the foundation that Ms. Thomas has been talking about. I mean, you're talking about incredible performers who have already laid the groundwork, and so you can't go across the world and you know, not uphold that standard. So that's kind of the two things that you really have to keep at the forefront of your mind every time you hit the stage, every time you interact with the people.
Al, can you respond to that about the kind of reshaping the images that some people might have of young African-American people in the States?
Yes, certainly I can, as it relates to Australia, as it relates to Europe, and even as it relates to America. And I'm sure if you think about it, those of you that are involved with the Stax Music Academy and have been performing you've noticed that even though that stereotype is there, people have reacted and treated you differently. And that's because of the difference. That's a part of it. That's a true art form that comes from our culture. The most powerful transmitter of the spirit, that positive spirit, is music. And when you sing the songs that you sing, conduct yourself as you will and have been and always conduct yourself, because you're trained and taught that coming to that academy, you become the example that they need to see. And I'm sure there will be many that will hear you perform and they will go away making it plain just based on reflecting and talking about your performances and what they experienced and what they felt, that, for want of a better way to put it, beyond all like what we've been seeing on television or in the evening news, that may be a segment of the African-American population, and hopefully they'll realize that it's a minority segment, because all of the positive things about us are skewed because of the negative stereotypes that the media puts out there, but that you will provide something different for them to see right in their faces so they can go out and tell others about it. And the other thing as I hear and I'm told about how you all are being received and the fact that you're going to, thank God, to Europe on this anniversary day, and me sharing with you what I shared earlier about how the people in Europe saw our music not through racist lenses, but as an art form that came from the African-American culture. I heard that back then, and it stayed with me because I began to appreciate what we were doing differently and at another level. And it caused me to say, back in 1975, when I was being attacked in Memphis and Stax was being attacked, I made a statement at now Memphis State University where I said to them in an address that was broadcast over radio that you cannot destroy Stax music, because Stax music is not in the bricks and mortar of those buildings or in those master tapes. It will live on forever because it lives in the hearts, minds, and souls of the people. And you all are a reflection of that. You're that example. You prove what I was talking about then, but my awareness and my appreciation and recognition of that was given to me by the Europeans. And ironically, you're going back over during this time of what we're experiencing in America, giving that example once again and letting them see that once again. And I'm so thankful for that.
Well, I got one more question for you, but I want the students to see if they got anything before we let you go. Sam?
Okay.
Didn't notice Redding do Satisfaction, the Stone song?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. I can't give him no Satisfaction. Yes, he did.
Whose idea was it to do that?
It was his. It was his idea. And we thought we didn't make too much of a noise out of it, but we thought, well, wait a minute, this is kind of crazy for him to do that, because it was blowing up the charts and a hit on the Rolling Stones at that time. And Otis had heard it and just had to do it and insisted. And, of course, when he did it, we forgot about the Rolling Stones, and as we released it in the marketplace, and I had the audacity to say, okay, well, I'm going to go on and release this record, even though I know the Rolling Stones are out there running up these charts. And Otis Redding took off in the marketplace. As a matter of fact, it was one of his fastest breaking records ever, if I'm not mistaken, or Satisfaction, but it was his idea.
Oh, he made it his own, that's for sure.
Yeah, he made it his own. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I've heard people say they thought the Rolling Stones had been influenced by Otis Redding and copied Otis Redding.
I'm going to go one more time with the students. If they have any other questions, then we'll let you go. Go ahead, Amber. I think Amber's got something. Yes.
Mr. Bell, what do you think about doing a movie on Stax Records? I think it's overdue.
Not only is it overdue, but within the past year, it's been at the forefront of my mind 1975, where all of that's together, because many people, because of the different labels that we had, they didn't realize it was all Stax music, because it was a Stax record, the Volt records, Enterprise records, and all of that. And I'm going to appreciate the kind of impact that it has had. And as a matter of fact, a gentleman from the Wall Street Journal told me this. He said the music that you all did between 1968 and 1975 was the most diverse, organized release of African-American music that has ever been in the marketplace. And that influenced rock, pop, rap, hip-hop, and all of that. He said, and they need to know, meaning Americans, people of the world, need to know that period, need to know of the music of that period. And we've been talking about getting that done, and I've also finally made up my mind to go on and do my life story. And I want to come back, and at this age in my life, and I still feel kind of like I'm, 28, 29 years old. But I want to come back, and I want to say it in her presence. The one thing that hurt me the most about Stax Records, irrespective of what happened to me and what I had to go through, was that I was unable to get Carla Thomas positioned to where she should have been positioned in this industry as a phenomenal artist, person, and performer. That has been one painful regret of mine. Circumstances interfered with me, and I couldn't do it. But I want you to know, Carla, that that's been a regret of mine that I've been living with from that day until this day. I want you to know that.
I swear this is the last question, but we're all together, and this is kind of, some of the stuff we're talking on is pretty historic, and I want maybe the students, and you and I have talked about this, Al, for some of the books. Can you just tell the students about your time with Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference back in 59 and 60, and maybe how, make it relevant to what we're talking about, organizational skills and spiritual skills, and just some of the things from that work with Dr. King that brought you into the arts and music world?
Well, I was in music in terms of being a disc jockey on radio, and playing record hops and all of that, and doing some concert promoting as a disc jockey prior to joining Dr. King in 1959. And the reason I did it was because my English literature professor in high school, Mrs. Virginia Robinson, insisted that I needed to go, and I don't know what she saw in me, but that I needed to go. I needed to stop, pause, and go and join up with Dr. King and attend his Southern Christian Leadership Conference students in Midway, Georgia, so that I could get that training and from Dr. King. It was leadership training. And it was about the movement, and it was also theological, because Dr. King was Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. at that time. And I went to, finally, at the insistence of Mrs. Robinson, because she wasn't going to leave me alone. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know who Dr. King was at that time. And she had me come by her house and called him on her phone and let me talk to Reverend King, and him talk to me about the leadership conference workshops, and invite me to come. And I went to the workshops and learned a lot. I had come out of the 1957 school integration crisis here in Little Rock, Arkansas. So I had somewhat of, not as much a passive attitude, but a protect myself attitude, if you will. We were taught that, and when I say taught that culturally, we were taught that, and my family, we were taught that. So I went into Midway, Georgia, well, my man, not wanting to have dogs bite me and not wanting to see the students involved with the dogs biting them and et cetera, and a lot of other things. But and share those things, because I guess I was a little, had some sort of influence on their thinking as I spoke in the classes and all of that. ain't gonna let nobody turn me around on the Tesla full of enthusiasm and excitement from the curb back to Main Street, from the curbs back to the buildings. It was just white people on both sides as far as you could see. And in front of me, as I was marching along, there was a white guy who was about 6'2". I'm 6'4¾". He was looking right at me, and he was calling me all kinds of names under the sun, just looking at me and calling me those names. Well, that didn't bother me, because I had been trained and taught that. But I got to maybe about 3 feet from him, and he went and spit on me. And before I knew it, I was out of my pocket with my switchblade knife. Going to all of those white people after him. And thank God, Hosea Williams had a black lady. I never knew her name, but she was wearing the first afro I had ever seen at that point in time. She came through and got me and took me, and we went back to Midway, Georgia. Late that night, Dr. King met with me and told me, and this is important for you all to hear. Dr. King told me, he said, Al, I know what you're about. I've been listening to you. And I know what you have on your mind about economic empowerment and economic development for us as a people. He said, but you see, Al, you haven't been any place further than over in Arkansas and over here in Georgia and maybe one or two other places, but I've been around the world. He said, and what you don't understand is the rest of the world doesn't even know that we even exist in America as a people. He said, so we have television now. So what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to continue to sacrifice. We're going to have to let those dogs bite us. We're going to have to let them hang us. We're going to have to let them do all of the things that they're doing to us. He said, and what will happen is that will be caught on television. And as a result of that, television will allow the rest of the world to see that we even exist in America as a people, but not only that we exist, but how they're treating us in America as a people. He said, then after that has been done, and I've achieved that, then you can go about doing what you're talking about, but what I have to do must come first. He said, and you know you violated me by coming in here with that switchblade knife and pulling it on that man. He said, I'm a theologian, and this is a Christian movement, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, well, you know, Doc, you know, I'm a theologian. I studied theology, and I'm a Christian also. I said, but Jesus had Peter with him, and Peter carried a sword. This is just a little switchblade knife. And Peter had that sword with him with Jesus. And Dr. King fell out laughing all on the floor. But at any rate, I would love for him left at about 3 or 4 o'clock that morning and drove to Nashville, Tennessee, checked in Brown's Hotel, slept there, and came on back to Arkansas. And won't go through all of the rest of it. But I never stopped communicating with him. And we, through stacks, made contributions and personally made contributions to SCLC. And the very day that he was murdered, I won't go through all of that, but a couple of weeks before that, when he was coming into Memphis, I had envisioned and saw and had a vision of what was happening to him with his Poor People's March that he was putting together. And I told him I was going to write a song for him. And I did. He said, all right. I wrote it and was in the studio recording it at the very moment that he was shot and killed. As a matter of fact, Shirley Walton was the artist that was singing it. The song was titled, Send Peace and Harmony Home. Well, I didn't mean back to the spiritual world. I thought it was time for Dr. King at that point in time to kind of take a break and back away from all of this. It was getting to be a bit too much. And he had done, in my mind, going back to 1959, what he said he was trying to achieve. He had made giant steps, you know, in that way, but I saw him moving into danger. So I thought he needed to just kind of back up for a minute. And surely, Booker T. Jones and Eddie Floyd helped me complete the song. And after after doing 8 or 10 takes on Shirley Walton, Homer Banks opened the door to the studio and said, Dr. King just got shot and killed. And the tape started rolling, the tape was rolling. And Shirley started singing. And she captured the essence of the song at that time. As a matter of fact, I gave it to our congressman, well, I gave his family some copies, and to Congressman Dan Kuykendall, and it was written into the congressional record. But I didn't manufacture any more past that. There's a lot more to the story, but that's enough. I just wanted to share that with you.
Well, yeah, and then we'll wrap it up. But I mean, that's the obvious. I mean, you know, Stax and the legacy. So much of the legacy is the political and the soundtrack of the civil rights movement. You know, we've talked about this before. I mean, maybe Motown didn't go that way, but Stax did that way. So it would be accurate to say it was kind of rooted as early as 59-60 with your work with Dr. King, that brought
right.
the political attitude here to Stax in Memphis.
Yes. And let me say to the students one thing that Dr. King, and I don't know whether he was echoing someone else or whether it was originally his, but he said, it's your attitude, not your aptitude, that gets you altitude. And that stayed with me from that day until this. It lives inside of me. It's your attitude, not how much you know academically and otherwise, that gets you altitude. It's your attitude. It's how you think, how you treat people.